Well, thank you for coming. Today I'm going to talk about something that we've been developing and particularly promoting over the last few years, but it is really the state of where we are now after over three decades of research on grape biotechnology. This current report is part of a SCRI grant. We're coming in, I believe, to the last year, second to last year, and starting to get some results. What I'm going to talk about is what I think is the current view of where we are in our developmental technology for genetic engineering. And it occurred to me a few years ago that we had really almost inadvertently rounded a major corner in our development of modified plants. And it allows us now to talk about it in a totally different way in the context of general botany, general biology, those kind of texts, those kind of levels of science. And I did want to mention, I already forgot, Dr. Lee here is my close colleague, and he's going to give a presentation next to show some of the nuts and bolts of how to recover plant-based genes that we need. I'm going to mention really kind of briefly muscadine, because all of this technology fits for us into grapes, and most of our development over the years have used bunch grapes. So a lot of the genetic analyses we do still are in bunch grapes. Muscadines are a little more difficult to manage, so we can go faster this way. Muscadine, I'm not sure how much people know about muscadine grapes, but they're endemic to the southeastern United States. They only grow in the regions marked mostly in Georgia, North Carolina. Florida's not the biggest producer. And they're generally considered to be delicious, but the problem is that they have fruit rot problems that make it so that the fruit cannot be transferred very well. Nothing like a bunch grape, like a seedless bunch grape that we see in the grocery store. And they have seeds. There are many varieties in the Southeast. As I think I mentioned, they're delicious. Most people like them a lot. The problem that we have, again, is fruit rot, but then also the first thing people mention, why are there seeds? So the goal of this current project, is to increase the market size and desirability of muscadine grape by increasing fruit rot resistance and inducing seedlessness via precision breeding. And I think I already mentioned, but the shelf life is not long enough, and they have seeds. What's precision breeding? This is a very specific definition that we're using. It's kind of made in a way to go into textbooks, the same way that mitosis is defined, meiosis, all these kind of things are strictly defined, and you go from text to text, it's the same. So it's an approach to plant genetic improvement that transfers only desirable traits among sexually related species by utilizing the mitotic cell pathway instead of the unstable variation-producing meiotic pathway. The outcomes are much more predictable than that from meiosis, and it allows us to do things that just cannot be done using conventional breeding, particularly for a self-incompatible crop like grape. Why do we want to do this? We believe that the plants produced this way will never have to be regulated. And I think you'll see why when I go through. And also some of the feedback we started to get quite a few years ago. I had approached the USDA BRS with the idea of producing what we were calling then a cisgenic grape. Very simple. Turner Thompson red, using grape genes, and we were approved to release it without any regulation at all. And that really was a bellwether for me. We jumped in even harder. We were always working on producing what we called plants with endogenous gene expression. And the terminology went very usefully to cysgenic. Cysgenic compares with transgenic. Now we're past that quite a bit. Now we want to talk about breeding. So it's very exciting to me. I think the future will be that all of these issues with government regulation for field studies and release will just go away. There's no reason. And what I'm going to do is... Louder? Okay, thank you. What I'm going to do is now provide the presentation that I'm giving to a lot of people. I left some brochures, before I forget, on the table, and they're aimed at people in the grocery store because it's a lot easier to understand now. Let me go back. I didn't say that. The key is that to get agreement, to reinforce that all crops that we use were intentionally genetically modified by humans, not by mistake, intentionally. And this began in the Paleolithic era with the domestication of plants, which is considered to be the cornerstone of modern civilization. Domestication equals genetic modification, always. And just a couple examples, tomato. It was first found by Europeans. Tell me again if I'm not. Found in Europeans by Europeans when Mexico was invaded. It was found from the Aztecs. It was considered to be poisonous and ornamental. And by record, by 1692, it was being used for cooking in Italy. And the interesting thing I always think of myself is before that, there were no tomato-based cuisines in Italy. So things change. Corn, teosinte, it was intentionally modified by Native Americans. They knew what to look for. They knew what to do. And over the time that it was done, the amount of modification of teosinte to corn is far greater than a breeder has ever accomplished with any crop. So to think that nothing's GMO but Monsanto corn and soybean is ridiculous. And we've allowed that to slip out. That's the feeling people have. So what about, and this is again, I'm talking to the choir, but this is how we talk about it now. Basis of breeding, and we mentioned all plants have two sets of chromosomes. Before mitosis or meiosis, the sets are copied. Sexual reproduction occurs. I'm going to go fast over this. I'm going to run out of time if I don't anyway. And then we come to meiotic variation, which is a key concept here when we start talking about all the worries people have had about too many gene copies, cutting genes in half with insertions. It's kind of crazy when you think just about general what we know at general botany. Meiosis is an evolutionary process, or demanded by evolution, to keep variation active. If we didn't need variation, we would all be clones. Literally. We wouldn't need it. Look what we miss out on. It's necessary for breeders, but it's not desirable at certain points, especially when you're finishing up a variety. You don't want variation. And the thing to keep in mind beyond just the shuffling, crossing over is rampant, where pieces of chromosomes or whole chromosomes move to another chromosome, and they can move either as a copy or the entire piece, taking it all with it. Lots of things. And then transposition, which is an enzyme-driven mechanism for genes and pieces of DNA to randomly move around. And it's interesting to note that 80% of the corn genome is organized through transposition. Transposition is considered to be the real fast driver of evolution. It happens very quickly. It can happen quickly. Happens all the time. It's not rare. A lot of transpositions result in lethal events, and you never see them. A lot don't cause any problems. But we go to grape, and we already know in the ancient cultivar Pinot Noir, considered to be the oldest, which has been sequenced, there were already at least 1,000 transposons way back when it was selected and cloned. And there's many more, actually. I wanted to show an example of what transposons do. This is one recovered. Really? Oh, no. I need two. I'll go fast. You can see these transposons cutting things in grape. This is an example of a promoter being cut by a Gret transposon. And I'll go quick. I always get too relaxed. So why do we want to do this with grape? Mainly because of the elite cultivars. Only 35 cultivars are grown worldwide on 60-some-odd percent of the acreage. But they have terrible disease problems. In Europe, some of these are sprayed 18 times a season. And you can't improve them by breeding, which is well known. Seedless you can, remember that, but not wine grapes. And so another approach is needed to do anything with these kind of grapes to increase disease resistance, lower chemical inputs. And what occurred to me is this. If we have three different technologies in place, which it is for most, we need to be able to grow single cells into plants. We need to have tools to insert genes into plant chromosomes. We need methods to then find genes and study genes. And that's how this is all coming together, and it's been coming together. This is number one for grape, single cell regeneration. You can see what appears to be a three-celled embryo. And we've had this going for many, many years. Gene insertion. We use very simple techniques now, and many, many crops can do this. We use green fluorescent protein as a marker in prototypes. It certainly doesn't go into the plant, but it's a fantastic tool. And then analysis. Fantastic software has become available. As soon as the genome for Pinot Noir was published, we were loading it into our computers and starting to study it. And these are some of the genes we have in field tests. We have VVTL1, Vitis vinifera tomatin like protein 1, PR protein 1, and albumin, 2S albumin. And these are all shown to provide disease resistance. This just shows some screening for powdery mildew. I'm going to go past that. Severity symptoms, different things. And then we come to an old study now from 2008 studying the Vitis vinifera tomatin like protein in the field. And we saw really good, reliable resistance based on greenhouse tests that followed the greenhouse test. And you can see on the left plants with black rot, on the right, none. It's a little bit misleading though, because after about 2 weeks, they all started to come together. There wasn't enough resistance. Now, and I'm not showing much. I've got a lot of stuff in between, but I'm trying to show the highlights. In 2014, we saw results, started to see results with PR1, and they're just amazing. It still holds up. Sauvignon Blanc, we keep planting the controls, they keep dying. And then this is, at 3 years, a Sauvignon Blanc with PR1. Thompson, same thing. Very interesting. This is what really grabbed me. Tomatin-like protein in Vitis appears in high concentration when fruit ripens. So even though we're expressing this thing constitutively throughout the plant, it seemed to really work better when the fruit came on. And this is Thompson from our field during our studies. You see the engineered ones, dried raisins, and these are clamshells on the benchtop. Nothing more. and the controls melt. Albumin, we saw these in the greenhouse, Syrah, can't ripen, engineered can. And then first, I have to throw some muscadine stuff in because it's lagging behind the bunch. But these are the first results we found with attempts at seedlessness. This is one of our new varieties, Delicious. And they both look the same with control and the engineered line. These are in Georgia with Steve Stringer and in Virgin Islands with Tom Zimmerman as well as us. And this is what's interesting to us. With this first gene we've tested, we're finding hollow seeds. The coat's there. Actually, we have the opposite of what we want. We'd rather have soft seeds in the inside. I'll go real quick. Sorry. That's about it. This is just a tally of what we have now going out, and it's accelerating. This methodology circumvents all the variation. It's very similar to a spore, axillary bud spore, where all nectarines and many things come from. And that's it. Thank you.